Do you ever catch yourself saying, English is just crazy? Maybe your students come across a tricky word and you tell them, you just have to memorize that one, or this is the part you have to know by heart. But deep down, you know it's still confusing. Here's the truth. English isn't random. It's a wonderfully complex system, and once you understand how that system works, through sound, structure, and meaning, everything changes. That's what Sarah Paul and I teach inside Mastering Morphology. This isn't another curriculum. It's deep teacher knowledge inside a practical comprehensive course that finally shows you how words really work. No more exceptions, no more gimmicks or patching holes with memorization or phonics alone. It's time to go beyond sound it out and give your students the framework they need to truly understand words. So if you're ready to stop guessing and start teaching with confidence, join us inside Mastering Morphology. Enrollment is open now, so we invite you to click the link in the show notes to get started. You're listening to episode 59 of Literacy in Color. It's a Friday in October, which means we have another special bonus episode for Dyslexia Awareness Month. Be sure to check the link in the show notes for the entire Dyslexia Awareness playlist so you don't miss a single conversation. In today's episode, we're chatting with Casey Harrison, who's the founder of the Dyslexia Classroom and the Wimberley Dyslexia and Learning Center in Texas, where she works with pre-K to grade 12 students in the area of literacy. Casey is a licensed dyslexia therapist, a certified academic language therapist, and a certified structured literacy dyslexia specialist through the International Dyslexia Association. With over 27 years of experience in education, Casey brings both deep expertise and a heart for empowering students and supporting educators. Casey is also a national speaker, co-host of the Together in Literacy podcast, and the author of her new book, Teaching Beyond the Diagnosis, Empowering Students with Dyslexia. Her work focuses on helping educators implement structured literacy in ways that honor the whole child, meeting both academic needs while also nurturing self-confidence and self-advocacy. I can't wait for you to hear this conversation. Let's jump right in. Welcome to the Literacy in Color podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Sullivan, a science of reading advocate with over a decade of experience as a reading interventionist and literacy coach. I'm passionate about making evidence-based instruction both effective and engaging. If you're interested in captivating our learners on reading fluently and understanding language, or as I like to call it, keeping it colorful, then you've found the right place. Each week, we'll explore intriguing lit bits and practical strategies around the science of reading and structured literacy to help you be colorful and teach colorfully. Are you ready to bring literacy to life? Let's color outside the lines and make an impact together. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Literacy in Color. It is a Friday in October, and that means we have another bonus episode for Dyslexia Awareness Month. And who better to have Casey Harrison from the Dyslexia Classroom join us today? And to be completely honest, I'm fangirling a bit because I have a long time been a follower of Casey's work for many, many years. And she truly is one of the OGs when it comes to this whole structured literacy landscape. And it's interesting because I was reading her bio and she's like, oh my goodness, it's been almost three decades being immersed in the science of reading research and what is now termed structured literacy. And I'm like, oh, well, then you've been teaching since you've been 5 years old. And what's exciting is Casey recently published a book called Teaching Beyond the Diagnosis, which is just a beautiful title as well. So she's here to talk about this whole idea of teaching our dyslexic children holistically beyond the diagnosis. So first of all, welcome to the show, Casey. It's such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Michelle. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know Casey, maybe Casey can introduce herself and share a bit about her background in this whole structured literacy world.
Sure. This is my 28th year of teaching. So yes, it's rounding the corner to 30 years, which is kind of crazy. I was really fortunate to start my career in the late 90s in schools that had already put into place some of the things that we see still here today, where a lot of structured literacy instruction using that explicit and systematic approach. Early on, I was fortunate enough to be trained in direct instruction, Dr. Engelman's direct instruction, and I saw how powerful that was for children. And also for myself as a fairly new educator, it really grounded my understanding in literacy and the value that breaking things down into really small incremental steps and having students reach mastery of those steps really set the stage for success. And then through my time in education, I've been in the classroom for many years, teaching kindergarten, first, fifth, sixth. I was a district literacy specialist for some time, as well as literacy specialist on my campus. And I also was fortunate enough to work in inner city schools across the United States. So I think that all of those experiences really added to my tool belt and helped me better understand kind of the literacy landscape that we have in the United States. And then in my teaching within the schools, I finished up at a specialized dyslexia school. And then now I have my own private practice where I work actively with children every day.
That's wonderful. And you're also a podcast co-host.
Yeah.
Together in Literacy with another rock star educator, Emily Gibbons. And I just listened to your most recent episode about what do students with dyslexia really need. And I'm looking forward to the rest of that season as well.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a big question. I'm really excited about the shifts that I see happening in schools surrounding kind of this wider understanding of bringing the research into our practices. My pause is that we make sure that we're addressing all students within our classrooms, both our students that are our advanced learners, making sure that they're getting what they need, as well as our students who need that extra support. So all the way around, making sure that we're really matching instruction to the students that are sitting before us.
Yeah, and making sure no one's left out of the conversation, mm-hmm. Definitely. And so what led you to writing your book, Teaching Beyond the Diagnosis?
Yeah. So in 2008, I guess, I had been teaching for some time at that point, and I still felt that there was students that were slipping by, even though I had all of this instruction and I had been teaching for some time and had lots of different trainings. And so that desire to really want to figure out what more I could do led me to discover that there is an even more specialized training that you can do. And so I was trained to become a certified academic language therapist. And so that was a 2-year, 220 plus graduate coursework hours and 700 clinical hours. And that really deepened my understanding of literacy and dyslexia. And from that time on, I was sunk. Like, that was what I wanted to do. And I just kept leaning in more. And so from that time in 2008 through 2010, when I finished my training, up until recently, I just continued to hone that craft. And so through that, I began to realize that children needed, yes, this high level of academic support and instruction that truly matched their needs, but so much more. We also needed to create this sense of understanding of dyslexia for the child, for the parent, for the teachers that were working with them, weaving in metacognitive strategies really intentionally to support the students on this journey, talking about executive function skills and working those into our lessons, as well as developing self-advocacy skills. Since dyslexia is lifelong and it will look different throughout a person's life, really knowing what dyslexia is and how to self-advocate is such an important part of the journey. And so the teaching beyond the diagnosis really encompasses this integrated framework that I've used with my students for many, many years with much success.
I love that you talk about this whole holistic approach to instruction and supporting students, because oftentimes it's like, well, the dyslexic brain works differently. We have to rewire the brain with explicit phonics instruction, and the conversation stops at phonics. But there's so much more than that. It's such a nuanced conversation. And I think your book really addresses that beautifully. And you emphasize that dyslexia is just one aspect of a child's profile. So how can teachers maybe shift from seeing a diagnosis of dyslexia, thinking that that's perhaps just the whole story of that student's issues with learning, to really looking at a child in this holistic approach?
Yeah. And I think this is something that, you know, in my experience, as I started to have a deeper understanding of dyslexia, I started to see how the tendrils of dyslexia impact so much more than just our reading and writing instruction, that our students will encounter areas where they're going to need support in math, or in science, or in social studies, or in driver's education, or as they advance into college. So I think that it is so necessary to have a deep understanding of dyslexia. But when we're looking at the profile, we really, oftentimes when we get those reports, we'll look at the data, which is so important, but we may not always understand exactly what that means. And so it is important to look for areas of strength as well as areas of need. And dyslexia exists on a continuum. So while we have students that all have this identification of dyslexia, what each individual needs under that diagnosis is going to vary from person to person. And so on the educator side, we have to lean in more to knowing exactly what that means for this child. Is this child particularly blocked in the area of decoding? Is this child maybe having more difficulty in the orthographic mapping or the orthographic code and having difficulty in spelling or in retrieval of spelling words? Is it a fluency component? So there are so many things within the academic side that we need to lean into more to have a deeper understanding for instructional purposes. The other thing to note is that dyslexia tends to have coexisting disorders. So while I know we like to kind of put things into nice, neat boxes, we are working with human beings that are beautiful and complex. And oftentimes we will have an overlap of coexisting learning difficulties or learning disabilities, such as ADHD and dyslexia. They do tend to have a very strong overlap, or dyslexia and developmental language disorder. And so when we're looking at this, we have to understand the whole child so that we can truly make sure that we're addressing all areas of learning needs.
Yeah, definitely. And to know that we have to be responsive to that child. And this is precisely why some people think that Orton Gillingham is like a curriculum. And it's not. It's not just this set of lessons that are prescribed that you just deliver and it's a magic wand. One of my friends is a fellow and she talks about, I can't pre-plan 10 lessons ahead. I have to make tweaks for the very next lesson based on the data that I'm taking in this particular session. And to know that we have to be responsive on the spot, it's not just teach this curriculum and things are going to change.
Yeah. And I love that you brought up that Orton Gillingham is an approach, just like structured literacy is also an approach. And so we may have programs that we're using to implement this approach, but they are grounded in these guiding principles. And those guiding principles are going to be that your instruction is systematic, that it is sequential, that it is structured and explicit, that it's cumulative, which is such a key part for our students with dyslexia to have ample opportunities for practice and ample opportunities to review information. So it's constantly cycling back, as well as being responsive in that moment, being diagnostic and prescriptive. So those who are teaching students with dyslexia really need to have a deep understanding of dyslexia, of literacy development, and language development, so that in that moment, you really can determine where that student needs the most support and what's the best way to match that support to where the student is at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that you mentioned before is that dyslexia is lifelong. So there's also this notion that perhaps you can cure dyslexia, and that's just not the case. What we can do is rewire the brain and build those pathways to make reading more efficient. And you've talked about how important it can be when we're looking at a child holistically to help students understand their own beautiful brains, right? So what are some of the ways that we can empower children in this work?
Yeah, that is such an important part. When we are looking at the academic component, we are targeting that instruction. But it is a different processing system. And while we're working to create the most efficient neural pathway or circuitry system for reading, what I have experienced through my work with children is that they really look at or interpret some things a little bit differently. So I have students, and again, as we're all humans, we all have our own unique fingerprint. We all have our own unique learning in terms of our own schema that we're developing. So with that in mind, there are some things that we may notice that our students are really great at seeing the big picture. Sometimes you'll notice that your kids, they just sort of get the gist of it, or that they are great out-of-the-box thinkers. Like, they will find the answer to the problem, but they may not go the route that you were expecting them to go. And if you stick with them and ask them how they got there, it's really quite wonderful to see their thinking in action. So I think part of what is really empowering for children with dyslexia is, first off, understanding what dyslexia is and isn't. It is not related to intelligence. And so often in our society, because literacy is such an important part of everything that we do in our society, it is necessary for our children to be able to read and write proficiently. We don't want to have any ceilings put on them, but we also want them to understand their own learning. And when they understand what dyslexia is and how it may impact them, maybe it's impacting them in math. Math has its own language, word problems. What are some strategies we're going to do for that? Or we notice that the fatigue of reading often, well, what are some things we can do? We can have audiobooks. Some of these things are going to set the stage for success for our students because we are building an understanding of the children. The children are also understanding how they're learning. What are the strategies that are working for them? What is helping them be successful? And then that leads into those self-advocacy skills. And dyslexia may look different at different stages. So yes, early on, we are trying to break the code. We're trying to figure out how to do that reading and make those sounds and symbols connect and stick. And then what does that look like when our students are now having to write more or having to advocate for themselves? So it is going to look different at different stages for different people, but with an understanding that we can help empower them as educators, they really are set up for success.
Yeah, and I love how your book offers even lesson activities to implement with students and even printables to utilize for that work, which is really helpful. And it's really helping students understand how their own brains work and maybe what their particular brain needs to be more successful. So that's really wonderful.
And that really taps into the metacognitive piece. When the students understand, like, hey, this strategy really helps me out, that, number one, makes them feel really successful, which is a huge motivation to then continue with that work because it is hard work. And it also lets them see themselves as learners. They see their success, and then they're starting to recognize, hey, this is working for me. In the future, I'm going to make a plan to ensure that I have this accessible to myself because it was supportive. So it's really weaving in this deeper understanding of how they learn and what they need. And it really is empowering for the students.
Yeah. And it's precisely why if a student with dyslexia does have an IEP, I know not every student with dyslexia will have an IEP, but for them to know that the accommodations and modifications on your IEP are not going to look the same from student to student because different students are going to need different things too. And PSA for child study team members, like we shouldn't be copying and pasting things from one to the next just because people do have the same diagnosis.
And that's something when I'm working with the students, I always want them to know what their accommodations are in school. And we'll practice making sure that those are useful tools. How do you use them? What would those tools look like in English language arts class? What would those tools look like in your chemistry class? What would those tools look like in world history? So that they see that transfer and it's not just in isolation. And when they see that, and they can start to have this understanding and this ability to advocate for themselves when they say, you know what, this isn't working for me. Is there a different way we can provide some support? That's really empowering. And it's also keeping the focus on the learning instead of what may be sometimes misunderstood or perceived as being a crutch or unfair, when really it is a tool. And if the student understands how to use that tool and can advocate, and the teachers see how to use that tool, it is really empowering. And that goes into the workplace too. When you talk to adults who have dyslexia, who received the best support, and they're readers and writers, and they're willingly telling their journey, they often will talk about tools that they use or ways that they self-advocate for themselves out in the world. So,
yeah. And I love how in your book, you even talked about how just because a student is having success doesn't mean that we take it all away now and just think that they can be free flyers without that as well.
Yeah, that is one thing I think I always like to caution parents and teachers. If we are seeing a student with success, let's look at what those accommodations are and how they're providing access to the curriculum so that the student is having success. Sometimes we will inadvertently take those supports away too quickly or without realizing that they need to remain. And when we do that, that really causes challenges for the kids.
Definitely. And you already mentioned how dyslexia is not a lack of intelligence, and some of our students with dyslexia are out of the box thinkers. And you have a whole chapter on contradictory signs of dyslexia. So can you explain how dyslexia can look different from child to child?
Yeah, I call this the contradictory because we have to understand dyslexia exists on a continuum and it will look different. And that what that means is some students are going to be really blocked. And so the severity will mean that the student may need more intensity or more assistance or intentional opportunities for practice and repetition. Other students may pick things up quicker when they're getting that instruction that they need. And so it can sometimes lead to contradictory interpretations from people where you would have a student that perhaps has really high language, really high vocabulary, and then when it comes to writing, there's this huge disconnect. Or we may have students that are in AP classes, and in class they're engaged orally, they're on topic. What may not be seen is why they need extended time. When they go home and they're doing that homework, it's taking them 1.5 to 2 times as long to complete the reading or the assignments than it is their peers. It has nothing to do with them being able to do the work. They just need that extended time. And so it can feel really contradictory where you have students that are sitting in your AP classes or your advanced placement classes, but they need extra time, or they need some kind of assistive technology to complete the assignments. And so if we don't have an understanding of dyslexia and we don't understand how it may look on that continuum, we may think, oh, well, they don't need that, or they shouldn't need it, or they should just try harder, which are all things that are going to be highlighting a misunderstanding and also contributing to some of the emotional components that we see as well.
Yeah, that leads perfectly into my next question, because in your book, you have this dyslexia iceberg. And did you invent this iceberg, or has this been around?
I had someone ask me that, and I'm like, I have presented on that for at least 10 plus years. So it was something that I just sort of like drew out for the kids, because when I was talking to parents, they're like, well, they could see the areas of academics where they were really struggling. And they could see like their maestro, they're not getting spelling, they're not getting the reading, they're behind in this, right? And so all these things that we could see. But what we weren't seeing were some of the things that were underlying, that were under that iceberg, under that water, which were feelings of shame, or it would start to impact social connections with the kids, or anxiety. All of a sudden you have your kids that school, they drop out, they don't like school, it's hard, along with frustrations and even some of the other components that we might not even think about. Like my high schoolers, sometimes they're like, I can't remember phone numbers. Now, this was back in the day before we had cell phones and you actually had to remember phone numbers, but they were like, I can't remember those. Or anxiety about passing driver's ed. And it wasn't the driving part, it was the written exam part. So there's a lot that lies beneath what we see in the academics. And when you ask me, you know, why did I want to write the book, when the publisher came to me, I had several ideas, but this was one that I really speaks deeply to me, because I think so often in the education world, we talk, and rightly so, about the academic piece. But in that conversation, and I saw this even when I worked in schools with myself, we were so focused on looking at the data, so focused on, are they making gains? What do we need to do? And it was just academics, academics, which they need to be. But at times I felt like we were missing the human being sitting in front of us. And we can't disconnect those. So the more that I leaned into my understanding of developing metacognitive skills and what the cognitive sciences say about retrieval practices and success and executive function, and just really seeing how all of these things are so interrelated, even though they're not seen on that tip of the iceberg, that's really where I have felt that I've been able to make the biggest impact for my students within the academics and beyond.
Yeah. It's interesting now too, with like the rise of AI, and people are like, oh, well, teaching is going to be out the window in 5 to 10 years because computers are just going to take over, and nothing can replace that human connection. Nothing can replace understanding the human in front of you.
Yeah. Well, and when we're working with students as humans, we pick up on these nonverbal cues, or like that fleeting vision of panic that you see just ever so slightly cross a student's face, where you're like, oh, okay, this is like, this just triggered something for you, right? Where computers are not going to pick that up. And the other thing, students with dyslexia need that immediate corrective feedback, and they need someone who in that moment can pinpoint where they had the breakdown and how to repair that to move them forward. And that really takes developing our craft as educators. And I think for me, I always say that teaching is, yes, the science and the art of teaching. We cannot separate those out.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that 1,000%. And just a funny little aside, as you were talking about the phone number, I was reminiscing of when I first met my husband, and I was like, I don't know his phone number. I have to like teach myself his phone number. And then I'm reflecting on my childhood, and I could remember my best friend's phone number from when I was 7 years old. And I was like, well, that was a multisensory experience. I was tapping it with my fingers. I was saying it out loud. Talk about working memory and holding three or four numbers at a time in my brain. Mm-hmm. And it stuck. And so when you said that, it really made me laugh.
Well, and you know, there's so much talk about multi-sensory instruction and people on different sides of the fence, but in reality, where our learning should be dual coded, it should be visual, listening and seeing. And if we can incorporate some kind of multimodal component, that's great. So if we think about when we're learning sounds and we're working on phonemic awareness tasks, we may start with just pushing items for those phonemic awareness parts. And what that's doing, it's holding that sound. It's helping to hold our sound in our phonological working memory. And that's really providing spaces for later on for us to add letters. And as we do that, when we are at that point where we're adding in letters, and then we're engaging in the handwriting piece with that, all of those are multisensory or multimodal teaching approaches. And that is strengthening those neural pathways in the brain to help us connect what we see, what we hear, and what we feel to really make it stick. And so I know I have a whole chapter on multisensory learning in the book because it is such a powerful piece, but it needs to be done with intention, with the purpose of getting that learning to stick.
Yeah. And I think the key word you said there is intention, and it's not just about being cute and I'm going to take out the sand tray to be fun. It's about being really intentional in the learning experience you're providing. And I love the example that you just gave with using tokens, because when we think about phonemic awareness, trying to build this awareness of our sound system, that can feel so abstract. And you can't touch a sound, but you can touch a chip that represents that sound and make the abstract a little bit more concrete. And that can be so helpful for some of our students.
Yeah. And for students, I know we actually didn't really even talk about dyslexia when it was, but for students with dyslexia, most of the time there is a phonological deficit. So students do need really intentional opportunities to work with sounds and play with sounds and manipulate sounds. So segmenting, blending, manipulation, and that may be done at that oral level, that auditory level, and also with letters. So knowing that when you have a student who is really struggling with that phonological working memory, you may need to start with those manipulatives and help them really develop that. Some of our more blocked students, even segmenting sounds is quite challenging. So knowing where your student is, again, and knowing their learning profile is so critical so that we can really match that instruction to where that student is, what they need, and also highlight their strengths.
Absolutely. And again, to know that not everything is a blanket statement for all students. And so you always go back to this unique learning profile. And to you, just a personal question, what does it mean to implement structured literacy and also honoring that individual student in front of you? It's like your Miss America question.
I know, right? Well, I actually love that question. And my perception is that they're one and the same. And I know that that may be very different from how other people are interpreting it. But the more you understand that structured literacy is an approach and that it really should be tailored to that student, they really belong together, right? You need to know where your student is. It should be data-driven. It should be highly interactive instruction. And we should be testing to understand where the student is, both in areas of need and areas of strength. Then we should be teaching, and then we should be testing again. So the whole point of testing is not to just get these data points. It should be to drive instruction. And when you're doing it that way, then you should be matching that instruction to that child's learning profile so that you really are meeting them where they are most needed.
Yeah. And then do you have a concrete example of how your intervention might look completely different from one child to the next?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every student that comes in, it's so different. I work, so for people who are listening, they're like, well, I'm in the school. I do work in the school as well. So I have two little schools in my area that I go in and I provide services for. One is an elementary school and one is a middle to high school. So very different groupings. And then at my center, I have students that I see either in small groups or in one-on-one settings. So it is going to look different from student to student. If I have some students who are focusing primarily on the written output. Like in my high school students, they may be fluent readers, or they have reached that point where they are at what would be considered fluent. We're still working on developing that fluency, but now we're really leaning into reading and then the written output. But the same structure applies, and the same approach would apply even in the written side. It needs to be really systematic. We need to break it down so that even if we were working at the high school level and my student was not clear on simple sentence construction, well, I would go all the way down to nouns, but I'm not going to use simple noun examples. I'm going to pull sentences from their world history book and have them identify, what is the noun in this? Oh, we're talking about the Greeks. It's going to match their level of instruction. Now, some of my little ones who may come in that may have more complex learning profiles, meaning that they have dyslexia and ADHD, dyslexia and ADHD and working memory deficits, dyslexia, ADHD, and maybe anxiety. So your children, they're unique and they're going to come in with their own needs. So my students, perhaps that have dyslexia and ADHD, I'm going to have some really structured on-task target behaviors that are going to be woven into their lesson. I usually start off with the alphabet. It's an easy, low-hanging fruit retrieval practice. It sets them up for success. And then we will do a review of some kind, whether that is usually it's our letter deck and then our sound retrieval practice. We'll go into new learning. So I'm linking what they've previously knew into the new learning. We have application at the word level, sentence level, text level, high frequency words, spelling instructions, and then connected text of some kind. They're all going to have sort of a similar structure, but within that, it's going to be really tailored to meet their needs. It is very unique for the student.
And it's clear you're a master at your craft and you're able to make those instructional decisions based on the student in front of you. And I love that example with your older student pulling from resources that they're learning about in their class, because that goes back to the self-esteem aspect again. And our older learners who are having difficulty with word recognition, like they don't want to be doing baby phonics and they don't want to be reading Pam and Jim sat on the mat. And there needs to be a way to build that self-esteem while still working on their skill level.
Oftentimes with my older students, if I have older students who are coming in at that real basic level where they are like still struggling with short vowel sounds, yes, I will work on those short vowel sounds, but I want to get them to reading two syllable short vowel words, right? Like we can do napkin, we can do picnic. We can start to see how these things come together so that you're right, they're not spending this mass amount of time on CVC words in isolation, but they're seeing how these syllable types that they're learning come together to build into meaningful words. And that includes bringing in morphemes right from the start. And I do morphemes with my kindergarten students. And even when we're thinking about pre-K students and kindergarten students, even at the oral level, thinking about morphological awareness, when you have a student that's saying, oh, I jumped it over the rock, right? They're experimenting with this morphological awareness. They just need a little help. So then you model and say, oh, you jumped over the rock, and you start to build that oral language to transition into the written language. But there's so much to unpack when it comes to literacy and language. And it's one of my favorite things about working with students with dyslexia, because the more you know and the more you understand about dyslexia and understand about literacy, it's almost like you get to be like a little detective and kind of figure out where it is that they are showing these areas of strength and these areas of need, and then how can you best support them?
Yeah, I love that example too with the oral language and morphology, because so many people will think, oh, that's for older kids and I can't start that work until much later. And it's so true. There's this aspect. We have those two sides of the rope. We have our language comprehension and our word recognition. We need to build up that oral language and provide opportunities to have language building as well. And going back to the self-esteem thing, do you just want to share one of your favorite strategies to promote the positive self-esteem with your students?
One of my favorite strategies. Oh, well, I think for me, helping them with some metacognitive awareness, and that is going to often start when we have students with dyslexia, especially students who have perhaps experienced repeated failure over time, that really wears down on your self-esteem, and you wear basically like a cloak of shame that they are putting on themselves. Even if the teachers are like, you can do it, right? Until they see these small moments of success, they may not believe that, because what's being more reinforced is that they're behind, that they can't do it, sort of these ideas that they may have. So for me, one of the best ways to start building student self-esteem is to be really authentic and find those moments where your students shine. And that may be, yes, in your lesson. It may also be making sure we're paying really close attention to them in the classroom so that you can say, you know what, Michelle, you ask really thought-provoking questions. I love that. That just shows me you're thinking so much about what we're talking about. And in that moment, just a recognition of what it was that the student did, sometimes they don't see that in themselves. I think as humans, it's easier for us. We're all kind of known to be critical of ourselves and compare ourselves to others. And so if we can take a moment to shine a light on that bright spot that they bring, it is so empowering, and it allows them to see themselves in a little bit of a different light, and it allows their peers to see them in a different light as well. And you have to gauge where you are with your student on whether that's a compliment you give in front of everyone or individually, but those small moments when you can do that in a really authentic way and they feel seen, it's really empowering.
Definitely. And I think the key word there too is authentic. And we don't want to force a compliment, and right, students will know if it's forced, right? Yeah. But to really see those special moments and let the student shine, that's heartfelt and sincere and authentic. I love it. So we're going to wrap up our time. If I'm going to give you a magic wand for Dyslexia Awareness Month, what's one shift that you would hope to see in maybe schools or policy or even mindset around dyslexia?
Ooh, okay. Yes, that's a big one. I would say for us to continue with dyslexia awareness beyond just the academics. So yes, understanding the academics, but really looking at that emotional and the well-being side and how that can impact our students, both within the school setting and beyond. If we can set students up to feel success, which is meeting them where they are, giving them that success, those small steps, honoring those, can really make big shifts for our students so that they aren't just always feeling like they're in this downward spiral of constantly behind and constantly feeling less than. So kind of shifting conversations around understanding dyslexia, but also focusing on progress being made. I know we have these benchmarks that we're all trying to hit, but along the way, really focus on the progress that that child made from where they began to where they are, and just know that it's a journey.
Celebrate the baby steps, because they are all important and they all matter. And it's time to teach beyond the diagnosis, right?
Yeah, it is.
So this has been such a joy chatting with you today, Casey. I am sure my listeners would love to connect with you further. If they don't already have a copy of Teaching Beyond the Diagnosis, we'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes. I think it's a must read for all educators. And people are definitely going to want to check out the Together in Literacy podcast as well for more information on dyslexia all year round. And where else can they connect with you and find more of your offerings?
Yeah, I have a website. It's called thedyslexiaclassroom.com. And on there, I have links to the book. And yes, as Michelle said, each chapter actually has downloadables that you can use with your students, as well as like reflection questions. And then I also offer courses and blog posts and just things like that to continue to spread the dyslexia awareness. So thedyslexiaclassroom.com.
There we go. All the golden nuggets. Well, thanks again, Casey.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into Literacy in Color. I hope today's episode left you feeling both inspired and equipped with something new to add to your teaching toolkit. If you're enjoying this podcast, it would truly mean so much to me if you'd leave a 5-star review. It helps other educators find the show and join our colorful community. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss an episode. For more tips, tools, and resources, be sure to check out the links in the show notes at michelleandthecolorfulclassroom.com. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week. Until then, be colorful and teach colorfully.